and this held true for as long as they remained worthy of guardianship from God, but when it was necessary for them, as a whole, sinning nation, to turn back to their God through hardships, they were abandoned now to a greater, now to a lesser degree, until, under the Romans, having committed the greatest sin of all in killing Jesus, they were abandoned completely. Next, after this, Celsus, running quickly through what stands in Moses' first book, the one entitled Genesis, says that they undertook to trace their lineage from the first seed of sorcerers and deceivers, calling as witnesses faint and ambiguous voices hidden away somewhere in the dark, and interpreting them to the unlearned and the foolish. And this though the matter had never, in all the long time before, even been disputed. It seems to me that in these words, he has expressed rather obscurely what he wished to say. It is likely, too, that he deliberately cultivated obscurity on this point, since he saw that the argument establishing that the Jewish nation descends from such ancestors was a strong one. And yet again, he wished not to appear ignorant of a matter concerning the Jews and their race that is not to be dismissed lightly. It is clear, then, that the Jews too trace their lineage from the three fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose names join to that of God. The designation, so that it is used in prayers to God and in incantations against demons, not only by those of that nation, but by almost everyone who practices spells and magic, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. For this invocation of God is found in many places in the magical writings, along with the adoption of God's name as though it were proper to these men for use against demons. This, then, though Jews and Christians bring it forward to prove that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, forefathers of the Jewish people, were holy men indeed, seems to me something Celsus was not wholly ignorant of, even if he failed to state it plainly, since he was unable to answer the argument. For we ask all who employ such invocations of God, tell us, sirs, who was Abraham and how great was Isaac, and of what power did Jacob become, that the designation God fitted to their name should produce such great effects? And from whom have you learned, or from whom can you learn, the facts about these men? And who indeed took the trouble to write down the history concerning them? Whether one that of itself exalts these men in secret terms, or one that through hidden meanings hints at certain great and wondrous things to those able to perceive them. Then, when we ask and no one can produce it, from whatever history it might be, whether Greek or barbarian, or not a history at all but some mystical record, concerning these men, we for our part will produce the writing titled Genesis, containing the deeds of these men and God's oracles to them, and we will say that surely the fact that even you make use of the names of these three patriarchs of the nation, grasping by plain experience that not inconsiderable effects are accomplished through invoking them, this itself demonstrates the divine character of these men, whom we take from nowhere else than the sacred books among the Jews. Indeed, he who is called the God of Israel, the God of the Hebrews, and the one who submerged the Egyptian king together with the Egyptians in the Red Sea, is frequently named and employed against demons or certain evil powers. And we learn the history concerning these named ones and the interpretation of the names from the Hebrews, who, in their ancestral script and ancestral language, extol and recount these things. How then did the Jews, in undertaking to trace their own lineage from the very seed of these men, whom Celsus has supposed to be sorcerers and wandering deceivers, shamelessly attempt to derive themselves and their origin from these men, whose names, being Hebrew, testify to the Hebrews, whose sacred books they have in the Hebrew language and script? Is this nation, then, akin to these men? Indeed, to this very day, the Jewish names, adhering to the Hebrew language, were taken either from their writings or, quite simply, from the meanings signified by the Hebrew tongue. And let the reader of Celsus's work observe, unless this is what he is hinting at, that they also attempted to trace their genealogy back to some original sowing of sorcerers and deceivers, calling as witnesses faint and ambiguous voices hidden away somewhere in the dark. For these names are hidden and not out in the light and knowledge of the many. To us, at any rate, they are not ambiguous, even when they are taken up by people foreign to our religion, but according to Celsus, not. Establishing the ambiguity of the voices, I do not know how he has thrown this in carelessly. And yet he ought, if he wished fairly to overturn the genealogy which he thought was most shamelessly adopted by the Jews, who boast of Abraham and his descendants, to have set out the whole matter, first arguing for it with whatever plausibility he judged it to have, and only after that nobly overturning, by the truth as it appeared to him, and by the oracles concerning it, the facts of the matter. But neither Celsus nor anyone else will be able, in discussing the nature of names taken up as powers, to set forth an accurate account of these things, and to prove that the people to whom they belong have become contemptible, people whose very names have power not only among their own, but also among those outside. He ought to have set out how it is that we deceive our hearers, as he supposes, by misinterpreting to the ignorant and unthinking the truth about these names, while he himself, who boasts of being neither ignorant nor unthinking, gives the true interpretation of them. But in dealing with these names, from which the Jews trace their genealogy, he has thrown out, in passing, the claim that there has never at any time in the past been any dispute about such names, but that now the Jews are disputing about them with certain others whom he did not name. Let whoever wishes point out who these claimants are, and whether they even have any plausibility, arguing against the Jews in order to demonstrate that Jews and Christians fail to give a sound account of these matters, of the people to whom the names belong, but that there are others who have grasped the wisest and truest account of them. But we are convinced that no one will be able to do any such thing, since it is plain that the names derive from the Hebrew tongue, a language found nowhere except among the Jews. After this, Celsus, setting out the accounts from history outside the divine word, concerning the peoples who have laid claim to antiquity, the Athenians, for example, and the Egyptians and the Arcadians and the Phrygians, who say that certain of them were earthborn, and who each offer proofs of this, says that the Jews, huddled together in some corner of Palestine, utterly uneducated and never having heard before these things long since sung by Hesiod and countless other inspired men, composed a most implausible and tasteless tale. A man molded and breathed into by the hands of a god, and a little woman from his rib, and commands of the god, and a serpent that opposed these commands and got the better of the god's orders, telling this myth as if to old women, and making the god act most impiously, weak from the very beginning and unable to persuade even the one man he himself had molded. By these arguments, then, the man of much learning and much erudition, Celsus, who charges both Jews and Christians with ignorance and lack of education, clearly shows just how accurately he knew the times of each writer, Greek and barbarian, he who imagines that Hesiod and a host of others, men he terms divinely inspired, precede Moses and his writings in time. Moses, who is demonstrated to be much older than the events at Troy. It was not the Jews, then, who composed the most implausible and most tasteless things about the earthborn man, but the men whom Celsus calls inspired, Hesiod and his own countless others, who neither learned nor heard the far older and most venerable accounts current in Palestine, wrote such histories about ancient matters as Theogonies as well, attributing to the gods, so far as lay in their power and origin and countless other things besides. It is with good reason, then, that Plato expels from his own republic, as ruining the young, Homer and those who write such poems. But Plato clearly did not think that the men who left behind such poems had become inspired, whereas the man more capable of judging than Plato, Celsus the Epicurean, if indeed this is the same man who also composed the other two books against the Christians, perhaps, in his rivalry with us, called men inspired whom he did not himself think inspired, applying to them the term inspired. He charges us with introducing a man molded by the hands of God, whereas the book of Genesis has taken up hands of God, neither for the making of man nor for his molding. But since Job and David say, "Your hands made me and molded me," concerning which much is the account needed to set forth what was intended by those who said these things, not only about the difference between making and molding, but also about the hands of God, which those who have not understood such expressions drawn from the divine scriptures suppose that we attribute to the God over all a form of the sort the human body has. On which reasoning it would follow that we also think there are wings on the body of God, since the scriptures concerning our God also say these things, taken according to the letter. But to explain these matters now is not required by the task before us, for we have already, so far as was possible, examined them in the first place in our commentaries on Genesis. Now observe Celsus Malus in what follows. For when our scripture says, of the fashioning of man, he blew into his countenance a breath of life, so that man came to be a living soul. Celsus, in his malicious wish to mock the phrase, he blew into his countenance a breath of life, which he has not even understood as to how it is meant, wrote that they composed a man molded by the hands of God and inflated. So that anyone who supposed inflated to be spoken in a manner similar to inflated wineskins might laugh at, he blew into his countenance a breath of life, as spoken figuratively, and in need of explanation. An explanation showing that God imparted to man a portion of his incorruptible spirit, in accordance with which it is said, your incorruptible spirit is in all things. Then, since his aim was to defame what is written, he also mocked the statement. God brought a trance down upon Adam, so that he fell asleep. Then he took one of his ribs, replacing it with flesh, and from the rib taken out of Adam, he fashioned a woman. And so on, without even setting out the wording that could alert the hearer that it was spoken by way of figurative interpretation. And he was not willing to grant that such things are told allegorically. Although further on he says that the more reasonable among both Jews and Christians, ashamed of these passages, attempt somehow to allegorize them. One might say to him, is it then that what is said by your inspired Hesiod in the form of a myth about the woman is to be taken allegorically? Namely, that this evil was given to men by Zeus in exchange for fire, while the woman taken from the rib of the one who slept after the ecstasy and built up by God seems to you to have been spoken without any figure and without any concealment at all. But it is not reasonable to refuse to laugh at the one as a myth and instead to marvel at it as philosophy expressed in the form of a myth, while at the other, fixing one's understanding on the bare wording alone, one sneers and supposes it will be of no account. For if it is on the basis of the bare wording that one must accuse things spoken with hidden meanings, see whether it is not rather Hesiod's words that will incur ridicule, words written, as you say, by an inspired man. But cloud-gathering Zeus, angered, addressed him. Son of Iapetus, knowing counsel beyond all, you rejoice at having stolen fire and outwitted my mind, a great affliction to yourself and to men still to come. To them I will give, in exchange for fire, an evil in which they will all delight in their hearts, embracing their own misfortune. So he spoke, and the father of men and gods laughed aloud, and he commanded famed Hephaestus with all speed to mix earth with water, and to put into it human voice and strength, and to make it resemble in face the immortal goddesses, the fair, lovely form of a maiden, and Athena to teach her crafts, to weave the intricate loom, and golden Aphrodite to shed grace about her head, and painful longing, and cares that consume the limbs. And to put into her a dog-like mind and a thievish character, he bade Hermes, the guide, the slayer of Argus, do this. So he spoke, and they obeyed Lord Zeus, son of Cronus. At once the famed lame god molded out of earth something resembling a modest maiden, by the counsels of the son of Cronus. And the gray-eyed goddess Athena girded and adorned her. And around her the goddesses, the graces, and queenly persuasion placed golden necklaces upon her skin, and around her the lovely-haired seasons crowned her with spring flowers, and Pallas Athena fitted every adornment to her skin. And within her breast the guide, the slayer of Argus, fashioned lies and wily words and a thievish character by the will of deep-thundering Zeus. And the herald of the gods put a voice within her, and named this woman Pandora, because all who have their homes on Olympus gave her a gift, a calamity for men who live by bread. And ridiculous in itself, too, is what is said about the jar. That before this, the tribes of men lived upon the earth apart from evils and apart from grievous toil and from painful diseases, which give death to men. But the woman, removing with her hands the great lid of the jar, scattered its contents and devised grievous sorrows for mankind. Only hope remained there within, in her unbreakable dwelling, under the rim of the jar, and did not fly out the door. For before that could happen, the lid of the jar closed it in. Against this man, then, who allegorizes these things so solemnly, whether he does so rightly, whether by allegory or not, we will say, is it only to the Greeks that it is permitted to philosophize by way of hidden meaning, and also to the Egyptians, and to as many of the barbarians as pride themselves on their mysteries and their truth, while only the Jews, in your view, and their lawgiver and their writers, seem to be the most foolish of all men, and this nation alone has partaken of no power of God. That a people so magnificently taught should ascend to the uncreated nature of God and look to him alone, and expect its hopes from him alone. But since Celsus also makes a mockery of the account concerning the serpent as one who works against God's commands to man, supposing the story to be some myth similar to those handed down to old wives, and deliberately named neither God's paradise, nor the fact that it is said that God planted it toward the east, in Eden, and thereafter made every tree that is pleasant to look upon and good to eat spring up from the ground, along with the tree of life set in the midst of the garden, and the tree bearing knowledge of good and of evil, together with what is said following these, matters capable by themselves of stirring a reader who comes to them with goodwill, since all these things are interpreted tropologically in no unworthy manner. Come, let us set alongside them, from Plato's Symposium, what is said about love, put into the mouth of Socrates, and how it is set forth more solemnly than everything said about him by all the other speakers in the Symposium, and attributed to Socrates. Plato's text runs thus: At Aphrodite's birth, the gods gathered for a banquet Poros son of Medes among them, and when the meal was finished, Penia came to beg, as was natural when there was a banquet and she was about the doors. Now Poros, having gotten drunk on nectar, for wine did not yet exist, went into the garden of Zeus and, weighed down, fell asleep. So Penia, plotting because of her own lack of resources to have a child by Poros, lay down beside him and conceived love. For this reason, too, love became a follower and attendant of Aphrodite, having been born at her birthday feast, and at the same time being by nature a lover of the beautiful, since Aphrodite too is beautiful. Being then the son of Poros and Penia, love finds himself in such a condition as this. First, poverty is his constant state, and he is nowhere near tender and beautiful, as most people imagine, but instead, he is rough and squalid and unshod and homeless, always lying on the ground without a bed, sleeping in the open at doorways and along roads, having his mother's nature, always dwelling together with need. But in turn, after his father, he schemes against what is beautiful and good, being courageous and impetuous and intense, a formidable hunter, always weaving contrivances, a lover of practical wisdom and resourceful, philosophizing throughout the whole of his life, a formidable sorcerer and drug mixer and sophist. And he is by nature neither immortal nor mortal, but on the same day he now flourishes and lives whenever he has resources, and now he dies, and again comes back to life on account of his father's nature. And what is procured for him always flows away, so that love is never without resources nor ever rich. Of wisdom, and again is in the midst of ignorance. For will those who come upon these things, if they imitate Celsus's malice, which be far from Christians, laugh the myth to scorn and hold so great a man as Plato up to mockery? But if, examining philosophically what is said in the form of a myth, they are able to discover Plato's intention, in what way he was able to hide, for the sake of the many, the doctrines that seemed great to him, in the guise of a myth, while saying that those who understood ought to discover from myths the intention, concerning the truth, of the one who composed them. I set out this myth found in Plato on account of the Garden of Zeus in him, which seems to have something similar to the paradise of God, and poverty, who is compared there to the serpent, and resource, who is plotted against by poverty, to the man plotted against by the serpent. It is not at all clear, however, whether Plato happened upon these things by coincidence, or whether, as some suppose, having encountered on his journey to Egypt those who philosophize according to the ways of the Jews, and having learned certain things from them, he preserved some and altered others, taking care not to offend the Greeks by preserving the wisdom of the Jews in every respect, since it was disparaged by the many on account of the strangeness of its laws and the peculiar constitution they had. But this was not the moment to recount either Plato's myth or the narrative touching the serpent, God's paradise, and everything set down there as having taken place. For we have already discussed these matters at length, to the extent we were able, in the commentaries on Genesis, where such matters are our proper business. And when he says that Moses' account, most impiously introduced God as weak from the very beginning and unable to win over so much as one human being of his own making. We shall say in reply to this that what is said is like the case of someone who charged God with the origin of vice, a thing God has proven powerless to avert in even one human being, such that not a single man since the beginning could be found free of vice's touch. For just as those who are concerned to make a defense concerning providence on this point make their defense with no small or contemptible arguments, so too those who have understood that Adam, in the Greek tongue, means man, will philosophize concerning Adam and his sin. And in what appears to be said about Adam, Moses is giving a physical account of human nature. For in Adam, as Scripture states, all die, and condemnation came upon them, after the pattern of Adam's trespass. The divine word speaking thus not so much of one particular man as of the whole race. For indeed in the sequence of what is said as though about one person, the curse of Adam is common to all, and there is no woman of whom what is said against the woman is not said. And the man cast out of paradise along with the woman, clothed in garments of skin, which God made for the sinners on account of the transgression of human beings, has a certain hidden and mystical, it makes some sense, beyond Plato's account of the soul's descent, shedding its wings and being carried down here, until it takes hold of something solid. Next he says something like this, then some flood and a strange ark, holding everything within it, with a dove and a crow serving as messengers, twisting and tampering with the Deucalion story. For I do not suppose they expected these tales to be exposed to scrutiny, but told them simply as stories for little children, they made them into myths. And in this, observe the unphilosophical hostility of the man toward the most ancient writing of the Jews. For since he was unable to find fault with the account of the flood, nor had he examined what he might have been able to say against the ark and its measurements, and how it was impossible, taken in the sense most people take it, that the ark, which was said to be 300 cubits in length, and 50 cubits in width, and 30 in height, could have held all the land animals, clean animals in groups of 14, unclean in groups of 4, he simply called it outlandish, containing everything inside. For what is outlandish about it, when it is recorded as having been made over 100 years and assembled with a length of 300 cubits and a width of 50, until the 30 cubits of height come down to a single cubit of length and width? And how would it not have been far more astonishing for the construction to be described, in terms of its capacity, as resembling a vast city, its length at the base being 90,000 units and its width 2,500? And how could one not marvel at the design, that it was made sturdy enough and able to withstand a storm capable of producing a flood? For indeed it was coated firmly not with pitch nor any other such material, but with bitumen. And how is it not astonishing that living sparks of every kind were brought in inside it, by the providence of God, so that the earth might again have the seeds of every animal, God having made use of a most righteous man, who was to become the father of those after the flood? Celsus threw out the matter concerning the dove, so as to appear to have read the book of Genesis, though he was unable to say anything to demonstrate that the account of the dove is fictitious. Then, as is his habit, translating what is written into something more ridiculous, he has changed the raven into a crow, and thinks that Moses wrote these things, playing tricks with the story of Deucalion current among the Greeks, unless indeed he does not even think the writing is Moses's, but that of several people. For that is what falsifying and playing tricks with the story of Deucalion indicates, and also this. For I do not think they expected these things to come to light. But how is it that those who gave writings to an entire nation did not expect them to come to light, they who even prophesied that this worship of God would be proclaimed to all the nations? And Jesus, saying to the Jews, "The kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a nation producing its fruits." What else was he arranging than to bring forward, himself by divine power, into the light the whole Jewish scripture, which contains the mysteries of the kingdom of God? Then, if they read the Greeks' accounts of the birth of the gods, along with the 12 gods' legends, they treat them reverently with allegories, but if they read the want to disparage our writings, they say outright that these things were made up as myths for little children. He calls the begetting of children absurd in the extreme and out of season. Though he does not name names, it is plain he means Abraham and Sarah. And when he flings out the plots of brothers against one another, he means either Cain plotting against Abel, or, besides him, Esau against Jacob, and a father's grief, perhaps Isaac's, over Jacob's journey abroad, or perhaps Jacob's, over Joseph being sold into Egypt. And by recording the schemings of mothers, I think he means to point to Rebekah, who arranged that Isaac's blessings should fall not on Esau, but on Jacob. Now, if we say that God is a close associate in all these affairs, what absurdity are we committing in believing that his own divinity never departs from those devoted to him, who live nobly and with strength of purpose? He also mocked Jacob's acquiring of property while with Laban, not understanding what the statement refers to. And the unmarked animals belonged to Laban, but the marked ones to Jacob. And he says that God gave the sons little donkeys and little sheep and camels, and he did not see that all this befell them by way of a pattern, and it was set down on account of us, on whom the culmination of the ages has arrived, among whom the various characters, becoming marked by the word of God, conduct their lives, given as a possession to the one figuratively called Jacob. For by what is recorded concerning Laban and Jacob, those from the nations who believe in him were signified. Far indeed is he from grasping the intent of what is written when he says that God also gave wells to the righteous. For he failed to notice that the righteous do not dig cisterns but dig wells, seeking to find the inherent spring and source of drinkable goods, since they also take up, in a figurative sense, the commandment that says, "Drink water from your own vessels and from the spring of your own wells. Let not your waters overflow beyond your own spring, but let your waters pass through into your own streets. Let them belong to you alone, and let no stranger share in them with you." In many places, the word made use of things that actually happened, and recorded them to represent greater matters signified beneath the surface, such as the matters concerning wells, and concerning the marriages and various unions of the righteous, about which one will attempt to give a clearer explanation more fittingly in the commentaries devoted to those very passages. And that wells were indeed constructed in the land of the Philistines by the righteous, as is recorded in Genesis, is plain from the wells still shown at Ashkelon, which are wondrous and worthy of note on account of how strange and different their construction is compared with other wells. As for brides and maidservants being interpreted allegorically, it is not we who teach this, but something we have received from the sages of old, one of whom said, rousing his hearer to allegorical reading, "Tell me, you who read the law, do you not listen to the law? Scripture records that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and one by the free woman. Now the one by the slave woman has been born according to the flesh, but the other from the free woman through the promise. These things are spoken allegorically, for these are two covenants, one from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery, which is Hagar, and shortly after. But the Jerusalem above, he says, is free, and she is our mother." Whoever wishes to take up the letter to the Galatians will know in what way the matters concerning the marriages and unions with the maidservants have been treated allegorically, since the argument wants us too not to emulate the bodily acts, as they are reckoned, of those who did these things, but rather those which Jesus' apostles are in the habit of calling the spiritual acts. And it was necessary that he, having accepted the truth-loving character of those who wrote down the divine scriptures, who did not conceal even the incongruous things, should have proceeded also concerning the rest and more paradoxical matters as not having been fabricated. But he has done the opposite even in the case of Lot and his daughters, having examined it neither according to the letter nor inquired into according to its deeper sense, and called it more lawless than the evils of Thyestes. Now it is not necessary at present to speak of the tropological interpretation regarding the place, what Sodom is, and what the word of the angels was to the one being saved from there who said, "Do not look back, nor stand anywhere in the surrounding region. Escape to the mountain, lest you be swept away with them," and who Lot was, and who his wife was, who turned into a pillar of salt precisely because she looked back, and who his daughters were, who made their father drunk so that children might be born to him through them. But let us console, in a few words, the seeming incongruity in the narrative. The Greeks too sought the nature of good things, bad things, and indifferent things, and those among them who arrive at it place the good and the bad in choice alone, and say, according to their own reasoning, that all things examined apart from choice are indifferent. And that choice, in its use of these, is rightly praiseworthy when used rightly, but not rightly, blameworthy when used wrongly. I said, then, in the section on indifferent things, that to have intercourse with one's daughters is, by their own reasoning, indifferent, even though it is not proper to do such a thing in established societies. And for the sake of a hypothesis, to establish that such a thing is indifferent, they have taken as their example the wise man left alone with only his daughter, the whole human race having perished, and they inquire whether it would be fitting for the father to unite with his daughter, so that, according to this very hypothesis, the whole human race might not perish. Is it then that among the Greeks these things are spoken of soundly, and the sect of the Stoics, no contemptible one, argues in their favor? But when a young girl, having learned about the conflagration of the world, but not having clearly grasped it, having seen fire engulfing their city and their land, supposing that a spark of the human race had been left in her father and in herself, should wish, on account of such a supposition, to repopulate the world, will she be inferior to the wise man of the Stoic hypothesis, who fittingly, in the destruction of all mankind, unites with his daughters? I am not unaware that some, taking offense at the intention of Lot's daughters, call it unholy they have supposed it to be his work, and they say that from unholy unions were born accursed nations, the Moabites and the Ammonites, and indeed it is not to be found that divine scripture has plainly approved this as having happened well, or has blamed and censured it either. Still, however the event stands, it is referred to an allegorical meaning, and it also has a defense of its own on its own terms. Celsus casts about the enmity, I suppose, of Esau toward Jacob, a man acknowledged by Scripture to be worthless, and without clearly setting out the matter of Simeon and Levi, who avenged the outrage of their sister when she was violated by the son of the king of the Shechemites, he blames them. And he says that the sons of Jacob sold their own brother, and that Joseph was a brother sold into slavery, and that Jacob was a father deceived, since, suspecting nothing about his sons when they displayed the many-colored tunic of Joseph but trusting them, he mourned for Joseph as lost, though he was actually a slave in Egypt. But see in what a hostile and truth-hating manner Celsus has gathered his material from the history, so that wherever the history seemed to him to contain an accusation, he sets it out, but wherever a notable display of self-control occurred, Joseph not yielding to the passion of the woman reputed to be his mistress, who at one moment coaxed him and at another threatened him, of that history he made no mention at all. For we might see Joseph as far superior to what is told of Bellerophon, choosing to be shut up in prison rather than to lose his self-controlled mind. For though he was able to defend and justify himself against his accuser, he magnanimously kept silent, entrusting his own affairs to God. After this, Celsus, for the sake of piety, recalls with a great deal of obscurity the dreams of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker and of Pharaoh, and their interpretation, through which Joseph was brought up from prison and given, by Pharaoh's trust, the second throne over the Egyptians. What then was there absurd in the account of the history, considered on its own, that he who entitled his work True Account, a work which does not set forth doctrines, but accuses Christians and Jews, placed these things among his accusations? And of the brothers who sold him, when they were starving and were sent on a trading mission with the donkeys, he says that the one who had been sold treated them kindly, doing things that Celsus did not even set forth. And he mentions the recognition scene too, though I do not know what he intends, or what absurdity he means to point out from the recognition. For not even Momus himself, one might say, could reasonably bring an accusation against these things, which, apart even from their allegorical sense, have great power to draw one in. He also mentions that Joseph, sold into slavery though he had been, was set free and returned in a procession to his father's grave, and he thinks the account contains an accusation when he says this, that by him, clearly meaning Joseph, the splendid and marvelous race of the Jews, having multiplied greatly in Egypt, was ordered to dwell apart somewhere and to herd flocks among the despised. And he added, out of his own hostile disposition, the claim that they were ordered to herd flocks among the despised, without showing how Goshen, the Egyptian district, is despised, nor the exodus from Egypt. He called it a flight of the people, without even recalling from the start what is written in Exodus about how the Hebrews came out of Egyptian land. But we have set these things out too, to show that Celsus assigned to the category of accusation and nonsense even things that did not appear worthy of accusation according to their plain sense, without demonstrating by argument what he supposes to be corrupt in our scripture. Then, as though he had devoted himself only to hating and being hostile to the teaching held by Jews and Christians, he says that even the more reasonable among Jews and Christians allegorize these things. And he says that, being ashamed of them, they take refuge in allegory. One might say to him that if the things according to the first, literal sense must be called worthy of shame, as myths and fabrications, whether written with an underlying meaning or in whatever other way, of whom should this be said rather than of the Greek stories? In these, sun gods castrate father gods and father gods swallow sun gods, and a goddess mother gives back to the father, in exchange for her son, a stone of men and gods, and a daughter is taken by her own father in intercourse, while a wife ties her husband down, enlisting helpers for the binding the brother of the one bound and his daughter. And why should I need to list the absurd Greek stories about the gods, which are shameful on their very face and yet are allegorized? Seeing that even Chrysippus of Soli, who is thought to have adorned the Stoa of the philosophers with many learned writings, misinterprets the painting at Samos, in which Hera was depicted performing an unspeakable act upon Zeus. For that solemn philosopher says in his own writings that matter, having received the seminal principles of God, holds them within itself for the ordering of the universe. For the Hera and the god Zeus in the painting at Samos are matter and God. And it is on account of these myths, and countless others like them, that we are unwilling even so much as to use the name Zeus for the god over all things, or Apollo for the sun, or Artemis for the moon. But practicing pure piety toward the Creator and speaking well of his beautiful works, we do not defile things divine even in name, excepting Plato's statement in the Philebus, where, unwilling to admit pleasure as a god, he says, "For my own, Prodarchus," he says, "awe concerning the names of the gods is of this kind. We, then, truly have awe concerning the name of God and his beautiful works, so as not to admit some myth even on the pretext of allegorical interpretation to the harm of the young. But if Celsus had read the scripture without bias, he would not have claimed our writings were incapable of bearing an allegorical sense. For from the prophecies in which the historical events are recorded, it is possible to proceed, not as from mere history, also to the histories themselves, as written with a view to allegorical interpretation and arranged most wisely, aimed both at the multitude of those who believe more simply and at the few who wish or are able to examine matters with understanding. And whether those regarded today, according to Celsus, as the more reasonable among Jews and Christians. They were allegorizing what is written. Perhaps Celsus might be suspected of saying something plausible. But since the very fathers of these doctrines and their authors give such passages a figurative interpretation, what else is one to infer than that they were written in such a way as to be interpreted figuratively according to their primary sense? We will set out a few examples from a great many, to show that Celsus slanders our scriptures in vain, as though they were not capable of admitting allegory. It is the apostle of Jesus, Paul, who states, "Within the law stands written, do not muzzle an ox as it treads the grain. Is it oxen that concern God, or does he say this entirely for our sake? For it was written for our sake, because the one who plows ought to plow in hope, and the one who threshes, in hope of sharing in the crop." And elsewhere the same man says, "For it is written that for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I speak it as pointing to Christ and to the church." Elsewhere too he writes, "We would not have you ignorant, brethren, that our fathers, every one of them, were beneath the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized unto Moses within the cloud and within the sea." Next, in explaining the story of the manna and the report that water came forth wondrously out of the rock, he speaks something to this effect. "And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from a spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." and Asaph, showing that the narratives in Exodus and Numbers are riddles and parables, as recorded in the book of Psalms, when he is about to bring these things to mind, prefaces them in this manner. Attend, my people, to my law, incline your ear to the words of my mouth. I will unlock my mouth with parables, I will speak forth riddles from ancient days, things we have heard and come to know, which our fathers recounted to us. But even if the law of Moses contained nothing written that was disclosed through hidden meanings, the prophet, in his prayer, would not have said to God, "Uncover my eyes, and I will perceive the wonders of your law." As it stands, however, he knew that a certain veil of unknowing rests over the hearts of those reading who fail to grasp what is expressed figuratively. And this veil is taken away as a gift of God, whenever one heeds him who made all things by himself and who, for the sake of that disposition, trained the senses to discern good and evil, and who very often said in prayer, "Uncover my eyes, and I will perceive the wonders of your law." Now who, reading of the serpent living in the river of Egypt, and the fish nesting in its scales, or of the mountains of Egypt being filled from the excrements of Pharaoh, is not led at once to ask who it is that fills the mountains of the Egyptians with so many foul-smelling excrements of his, and what the mountains of the Egyptians and what are the rivers in Egypt about which the aforementioned Pharaoh boasts, saying, "The rivers are mine, and I made them." And what is the dragon that corresponds to the rivers that will be shown from the interpretation, and what are the fish among its scales? And why should I go to greater lengths establishing what needs no establishing? Concerning which it is said, "Who is wise and will understand these things?" Or "Who is intelligent and will know them?" I have extended the discussion further, because I wanted to show that Celsus has not spoken soundly, in saying that the more reasonable among Jews and Christians attempt somehow to allegorize these things, when in fact they are not such as to admit of any allegory, but have quite plainly been mythologized in the silliest way. For the Greek myths have been fashioned not only far more silly, but also far more impious, for our own writings have also taken aim at the multitude of the simpler folk, something the makers of the Greek fictions did not guard against. That is why Plato, not without good reason, expels from his Republic myths of this sort and poems of this kind. It seems to me, too, that I have heard there are treatises containing the allegories of the law, which, had he read them, he would not have made this claim. For at any rate, the allegories that are supposed to have been written about them are far uglier and more absurd than the myths, joining together things that can in no way whatsoever be fitted together, by some astonishing and utterly senseless folly. He seems to be speaking here about the writings of Philo, or even of still older writers, such as those of Aristobulus. I conjecture that Celsus has not read these books, since in many places it appears to me that he has been so ill-informed that even those among the Greeks who practice philosophy would be captured by the things he says. Among them, not only is the diction well-crafted, but also the thoughts and doctrines and the use of what Celsus supposes to be myths taken from the scriptures. I myself know also Numenius the Pythagorean, a man who expounded Plato far better and championed the doctrines of the Pythagoreans, in many places of his writings, setting forth the sayings of Moses and the prophets, and interpreting them figuratively in no unpersuasive way, as in the treatise called the Hupo, and in his works on Numbers and on Place. And in the third book on the Good, he also sets forth a certain story about Jesus, without saying his name, and interprets it figuratively. Whether successfully or unsuccessfully is a matter for another occasion to discuss. He also sets forth the story about Moses and Jannes and Jambres. But we do not take pride in that account. Rather, we welcome him all the more than Celsus and the other Greeks, because he was willing, out of love of learning, to examine our writings as well, and was moved as by writings that admit of figurative interpretation and are not foolish. Next after these, having selected from all the writings containing allegories and narratives, composed in language not to be despised, he says that the cheaper sort, capable of contributing something toward belief for the many and the simpler, but not able to move the more intelligent, is the kind of thing he recognized in the dispute of a certain Papiscus and Jason, worthy not of laughter, but rather of pity and hatred. For my part, it is not my purpose to refute these things, for they are plain to everyone, I think, and especially if, someone would endure and put up with hearing their writings. But I want rather to teach nature this, that God made nothing mortal, but the works of God are all immortal, and mortal things belong to those others. And soul is a work of God, but body is of another nature. And in this respect the body of a bat, or a worm, or a frog, or a human will differ not at all, for the matter is the same, and their corruptibility is alike. Nonetheless, I would wish that anyone whatsoever, having heard Celsus talking grandly and asserting that the treatise entitled The Dispute of Jason and Papiscus Concerning Christ is worthy not of laughter but of hatred, would take the little book in hand and endure and put up with hearing what is in it, so that from this very fact he might condemn Celsus, finding nothing worthy of hatred in the book. And if one reads it without partisanship, he will find that the book does not even provoke laughter, in which is recorded a Christian debating with a Jew from the Jewish scriptures, and showing that the prophecies about Christ apply to Jesus, even though the other party maintains the Jewish role in the argument not ignobly nor unbecomingly. I do not know how the incompatible things, which by nature cannot occur together in human nature, he brought together and said that book was worthy of both pity and hatred. For everyone will agree that the one who is pitied is not hated when he is pitied, and the one who is hated is not pitied when he is hated. But Celsus says that he does not propose to refute these things for this reason, since he supposes them to be obvious to everyone, even prior to the logical refutation, as being worthless and worthy of both pity and hatred. We urge the reader of this defense, written against Celsus's accusation, to bear with it and to listen to our writings, and, as far as possible, to conjecture from what has been written the intention of those who wrote it, and their conscience, and their disposition. For he will find men arguing fervently about what they have come to believe, some of them also displaying also the recording of a history that has been seen and grasped as extraordinary and worthy of writing for the benefit of those who will hear it. Or let someone dare to say that believing in the God of the universe, and doing everything with reference to pleasing him in every matter, and thinking nothing displeasing to him, is not the source and origin of every benefit, as though not only words and deeds, but also thoughts are to be judged. And what other account could turn human nature more attentively toward living well than faith, or the conviction that the God over all watches over everything we say and do, and even think? For let whoever wishes compare another path, one that turns and improves not merely one person, or a second, but as many as possible, so that by setting the two paths side by side one may accurately discern which account disposes toward the good. Since, in the passage of Celsus that I set out, which paraphrases certain things from the Timaeus, it is written that God made nothing mortal but only immortal things, while what is mortal is the handiwork of others, and the soul, indeed, is the work of God, but the body has a different nature, and a human body differs in no respect from the body of a bat or a worm or a frog. The matter underlying them is identical, and their liability to decay is equal. Come, let us discuss these points too briefly, refuting the man who either does not acknowledge his own Epicurean opinion, or, as one might say, later changed to better views, or, as someone else might say, is merely the namesake of the Epicurean. For it was such things he ought to have declared, and to have argued the contrary, proposing this not only to us, but also to the not ignoble school of philosophers descended from Zeno of Citium, namely, to demonstrate that animal bodies owe nothing to God's workmanship, and that the great skill evident in them has not come from the primal mind. And regarding the many kinds of plants too, governed by an inherent, unperceiving nature, and having come into being for use, not something to be despised in the universe as a whole, for the benefit of human beings and of the animals that serve human beings, however else they might exist, he ought not merely to have declared, but also to have taught that no perfect mind produced such great and varied qualities in the matter of the plants. But if he once made gods the craftsmen of all bodies, on the ground that soul alone is the work of God, how was it not the next step for him, who is dividing up so many works of craftsmanship and assigning them to many, to construct, with some argument not to be despised, distinctions among the gods? These fashioning human bodies, others, let us say, the bodies of cattle and others of wild beasts. And he ought, seeing gods as craftsmen of serpents and asps and basilisks, and that there are certain craftsmen for each individual species of these, and others for the species of each plant and each herb, to state the causes of these divisions. For perhaps, had he devoted himself to the precision of the inquiry proper to this subject, he would either have maintained one God as craftsman of all things, who made each thing for some purpose and for the sake of something, or, if he did not maintain this, he would have seen what defense he ought to offer regarding a matter that is, to his own view of nature, a matter of indifference, namely, that of what is perishable. And that it is nothing absurd for a world composed of dissimilar things to have come into being through a single craftsman, who fashions the differences among the species to the advantage of the whole. Or at the very least, he ought not even to have made a pronouncement at the outset about so weighty a doctrine, if he was not going to demonstrate what he professed to teach. Unless, of course, the man who reproaches those who profess mere belief himself wanted us to believe the things he had merely declared, even though he professed not to declare but to teach. I am not yet even saying that he would have noticed, had he put up with and consented to listen to the writings, as he calls them, of Moses and the prophets, why it is that God made is used with reference to heaven and earth, and of the so-called firmament, and further also of the lights and the stars, and after these of the great sea creatures, and of every living soul among the creeping things which the waters brought forth according to their kinds, and of every winged bird according to kind, and next, after these of the beasts of the earth according to kind, and of the cattle according to kind, and of all the creeping things of their kind, and last of all in the case of man. But since he made is not said concerning the other things, the text is content, in the case of light, with let there be light, and in the case of the single gathering together of all the water under the whole of heaven, with and it was so. And likewise also in the case of the things that sprouted from the earth, when the earth brought forth vegetation, grass sowing seed according to its kind and according to likeness, and a fruit-bearing tree producing fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind, upon the earth. And he would have asked whether the written commands of God concerning the coming into being of each part of the world were spoken to someone or to several persons, and he would not so readily have accused as unintelligible, and as possessing no hidden understanding, the things written either by Moses in these passages, or, to put it in our own words, by the divine spirit reciting in Moses, from which he also prophesied, since he knew better than those among the poets who are said to have learned such things from seers, the things that are, the things that will be, and the things that were before. Further, since Celsus says that the soul is a work of God, while the body is of a different nature, and that in this respect the body of a bat, a maggot, a frog, or a human being will differ in no way, since the matter is the same and their corruptibility alike. We must also say in reply to this argument of his that if a bat's body, a maggot's, a frog's, and a human being's all rest upon identical matter, so that these bodies will not differ from one another, then clearly the bodies of these will not differ from those of the sun, the moon, the stars, the heaven, or of anything else whatsoever termed among the Greeks a perceptible God. For the same matter, which underlies all bodies, is in its own proper account without quality and without shape, and I do not know, on Celsus's principles, since he does not wish anything corruptible to be a work of God, by what it is that it receives its qualities. For whatever is corruptible must necessarily, in every case, since it has come to be out of the same underlying matter, be, according to Celsus, of like character to its own account. Unless, that is, Celsus, hard-pressed at this point, will leap away from Plato, who makes the soul out of a certain mixing bowl, and take refuge instead with Aristotle and the Peripatetics, who say that the ether is immaterial and that it is of a fifth nature besides the four elements, a position on which both the Platonists and the Stoics have taken their stand, and not without reason. And we too, despised though we are by Celsus, will take our stand when we are called upon to explain and to establish what is said in the prophet thus: the heavens will perish, but you will remain, and they will all grow old like a garment, and like a cloak you will roll them up like a garment, and they will be changed. But you are the same, you are. Still, it is enough to answer Celsus, even granting this much, that though the soul is a work of God while the body is of a different nature, the logical consequence of his own position is that the body of a bat, or a maggot, or a frog does not differ at all from an ethereal body. See, then, whether one ought to side with someone who accuses the Christians on the basis of such doctrines, while abandoning his own argument by granting that there is a difference among bodies owing to the qualities attached to them and concerning bodies. For we too know that there are both heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, and that the glory of heavenly bodies is one thing and that of earthly ones another, and that not even heavenly bodies share the same glory. For the sun's splendor is one thing, and the splendor belonging to the stars another, and even among the stars themselves, one star outshines another in splendor. Therefore also the resurrection of the dead we accept. We say that changes occur in the qualities present in bodies, since some of them, though put into the ground perishable, come up imperishable, and put in dishonor are raised in glory, and put in weakness rise again in power, and natural bodies, when sown, are raised as spiritual bodies. As for the underlying matter being receptive of the qualities the Creator wishes, all of us who accept providence maintain this. And when God wills it, the quality now present regarding this matter is of a certain kind, and afterward, let us say, of another kind, better and different. And since there are also ordered paths of the changes that occur in bodies, from the time the world exists and for as long as it exists, I do not know whether, once a new and different path has taken over after the destruction of the world, the very path which our own discourses call the consummation, it would not be surprising if, in the present case, a snake, transformed from a dead human being, as most people say, arises from the spinal marrow, and a bee arising from an ox, a wasp born of a horse, and a beetle springing from a donkey, and, quite simply, worms out of most bodies. Celsus supposes this shows that none of these creatures is God's work, but rather that the qualities, I do not know from where being thus ordered, come to be these from those, are not the work of some divine reason altering the qualities in matter. Further, we say this too to Celsus, who asserted, the soul stands as God's work, whereas the body belongs to another nature, and who has thrown out so great a doctrine, not only without preparation, but also without definition. For he did not make clear whether every soul is a work of God, or only the rational one. We say to him, then, if every soul without exception is God's work, this plainly takes in even the souls of irrational and most worthless creatures, so that for every body too, there would be a nature different from that of the soul. Yet he seems, in what follows, in which he even says that irrational animals are dearer to God than we are and have a purer conception of the divine, to be establishing that not only the soul of human beings, but much more also that of irrational animals is the work of God, since that is what follows once one calls those creatures dearer to God than ourselves. But if only the rational soul is the work of God, then first, he did not make this clear. And second, it follows from his having spoken without definition about the soul that it is not every soul, but only the rational soul that is the work of God, and that not every body has a different nature. But if not every body has a different nature, but rather the body of each animal is proportionate to its soul, it is clear that wherever the soul is the work of God, its body would differ from the body in which dwells a soul that is not the work of God. And thus it would prove false the body of a bat, or a worm, or a frog would differ not at all from that of a human being. For indeed, it would be absurd for stones to be considered purer or more polluted than other stones, and buildings than other buildings, on the ground that they were constructed in honor of the divine, or for the reception of the most dishonorable and accursed bodies, while bodies did not differ from bodies according to whether the beings dwelling in them were rational or irrational, and among rational beings, whether they were the more excellent or the basest of men. It is just such a notion that has emboldened some to deify the bodies of distinguished persons, on the ground that they received a noble soul, and to cast away or dishonor the bodies of the basest, not because such a practice is altogether sound, but because it took its origin from some sound conception. Or will the wise man, in like manner, after the death of Ennetus and Socrates, concern himself with the burial of Socrates' body and that of Ennetus, and build a similar mound or tomb for both alike? And this too, because none of these things is the work of a god, the same God who is said to be responsible both for the human body and for the snakes that come from that body, and for the body of an ox and the bees born from an ox's body, and for the body of a horse or of an ass, together with the wasps born from a horse and the beetles born from an ass. On account of which we were compelled to take up again the point that soul is the work of God, but body is of a different nature. Then next he says that the nature of all the aforesaid bodies is common, and one, going out into a reciprocal exchange and returning again. And it is clear from what has already been said in reply to this too, that the nature is common not only to the bodies previously enumerated, but also to the heavenly bodies. And if this is indeed so, it is clear that, according to him, though I do not know whether it is also so in truth, the nature of all bodies is one, going out into a reciprocal exchange and returning again. And it is clear that this holds according to those who hold that the world is corruptible. But even those who do not hold the world to be corruptible, while refusing to admit a fifth body, will try to show that according to them too the nature of all bodies is one, going out into a reciprocal exchange and returning again. And in this way, even that which perishes persists into change. For the substrate matter persists when the quality perishes, according to those who introduce it as ungenerated. If, however, some argument should be able to demonstrate that it is not ungenerated but came to be for some particular need, plainly it does not share, as regards permanence, the same nature supposed for that which is ungenerated. But it does not lie before us now, as we meet Celsus' accusations, to discourse on natural philosophy. He says that nothing born of matter is immortal. And in reply to this, it will be said that, if in truth nothing sprung from matter is immortal, then one alternative is that the whole world is immortal, and not as being born of matter, or it too is not an immortal thing. If then the world is immortal, a view also welcomed by those who hold that God's work is the soul alone, itself said to have arisen from a certain mixing bowl, let Celsus show that it did not come to be out of qualityless matter, while holding to the principle that nothing born of matter is immortal. But if since the world is the offspring of matter, the world is not immortal, the world is mortal. Is it then also subject to destruction or not? For if it is subject to destruction, it will be, as the work of God, subject to destruction. And then in the destruction of the world, what will the soul, which is God's work, do? Let Celsus say. But if, twisting the concept of immortal, he says that though it is destructible, it is nevertheless not destroyed, and is thus immortal, as being receptive of death yet not in fact dying. Clearly on his view, something will be at once mortal and immortal by being receptive of both. And there will be a mortal thing that does not die, and what is not immortal by nature will, contrary to not dying, be called immortal in its own peculiar sense. By what meaning, then, does he distinguish and say that nothing born of matter is immortal? And you see that these notions, when pressed and put to the test, are refuted by the very letters that contain them, since they do not admit of anything noble or unassailable. Having said this, he adds that on this subject so much is sufficient, and if anyone is able to hear and inquire further, he will know. Let us then, who by his reckoning are unintelligent, see what follows for one who is able even to hear a little of him and to inquire. Next, what has been investigated in various ways, through many arguments not to be despised, concerning the nature of evils and explained in different ways, he thinks we can learn through a few little phrases, saying, evils in existing things have neither in the past nor now nor in the future been less or more. For the nature of the whole is one and the same, and the coming to be of evils is always the same. This too seems to have been paraphrased from the passages in the Theaetetus, where the Socrates of Plato says, but it is not possible for evils to be destroyed from among men, nor can they be established among the gods, and so on. And it seems to me that he has not even heard Plato accurately. This man who claims to encompass the truth in this one treatise of his, and who entitles his book against us True Doctrine. For the passage in the Timaeus which says, whenever the gods cleanse the earth with water, has shown that the earth, once cleansed by the waters, has fewer evils than it had in the time before its cleansing. And we say this, in agreement with Plato, that evils are at some times fewer, because of the passage in the Theaetetus which says that it is not possible for evils to be destroyed from among men. but I do not know in what way, positing providence, he says, so far as the wording of this book goes, that evils are neither more nor fewer, but as it were fixed in number, thereby doing away with the excellent doctrine that vice and evils are indeterminate and, by their own nature, unlimited. And it seems to follow from the claim that evils have neither become nor are nor will become fewer or more, that just as, according to those who hold the world to be indestructible, the equal balance of the elements comes about through providence, which does not allow any one of them to gain the advantage, lest the world be destroyed. So likewise a kind of providence, as it were, stands guard over evils, which happen to be just so many, so that they may become neither more nor lesser. And Celsus's account of evils is refuted in another way as well, from the philosophers who have examined and set forth the truth about goods and evils, and from history, that at first the courtesans, wearing masks, hired themselves out to those who wanted them outside the city, but later, growing contemptuous, they set aside the masks, and since the laws did not permit them to enter the cities, they stayed outside them. But as depravity increased day by day, they eventually dared even to enter the cities. Chrysippus reports this in his introduction on good and evil things.